You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, the numbers are out on how many refugees came to Wisconsin last year. An editor at WisConText tells us how those numbers have changed over time.
First, the issue of allocating money for a U.S.-Mexico border wall is still at a stalemate, with President Trump and many Republicans saying a wall is necessary to keep out illegal drugs and the crime that comes with them.
Opponents of the idea, however, point out that much of the cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl entering the country comes through at legal points of entry or through other locations altogether. So what is the reality when it comes to how drug markets operate and where drugs are coming from?
Fonda Felba Brown is an expert on the international drug trade and a senior fellow in the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution. Fonda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I know we've got different kinds of opioids that are part of the opioid epidemic here in the country. I want to start with heroin itself in particular. What do we know about how heroin ends up coming into the United States?
Most heroin that is consumed in the United States comes from Mexico. It is produced, it is cultivated and produced into heroin in central parts of Mexico in areas called the Tierra Caliente, the hotlands, where government control has traditionally been weak and where you have very poor marginalized populations who grow the poppy and are very susceptible to control by criminal gangs. That heroin is then smuggled across the border into the U.S. The vast majority of that heroin, just like the cocaine, meth, and fentanyl that you mentioned, comes through legal ports of entry.
Right. Can you talk about physically how it's transported? Is it just in vehicles, trucks? How does it physically cross at those points of entry?
So there are multiple mechanisms. Lots of the heroin that goes through legal points of entry goes in cars. It's hidden sometimes in various special compartments in personal vehicles. Oftentimes, drug trafficking groups send several vehicles at the same time. They even alert for the patrol that one has drugs. They do it on purpose. They leak a tip, so that officers concentrate on that interdiction while other cars with heroin or other drugs go through other legal ports of entry or other areas.
So they actually sacrifice one car full of drugs to sneak a bunch of others through?
Absolutely. So, you know, traffickers have a great ability to control how much production takes place, and they routinely estimate that they might lose 30, 40, 50% through interdiction. They build these calculations into how much cultivation takes place and how much of the drug they buy from farmers. So absolutely, it's just routine part of the calculation, and it's often a common strategy to alert, to leak a tip off, to alert that one port of entry has contraband being smuggled through, so other ports of entry or other vehicles get through. Cocaine and heroin and fentanyl also get put in trucks, in trailer trucks. They're hidden in various cars, various kinds of cargo, from frozen fish to chili peppers to all kinds of industrial products. Endless innovation in the smuggling, and we have to realize that the entire U.S. drug market for a year can be supplied by several trailer trucks worth of drugs, the entire U.S. Drug market for a year. So you have thousands, tens of thousands of trucks crossing the border every day. You can imagine how difficult it is to find the few trucks that carry a small portion of the drug, given the enormous amount of traffic.
Talking to Fonda Felba Brown from the Brookings Institution about how opioids and other illegal drugs are brought into the United States. Fonda, we talked to Congressional Representative Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin, a Republican. Here's what he had to say in response to the idea that most drugs are coming across legal points of entry that you've been talking about on the border. Here's a listen.
The reason they're not catching as much in not points of entry is because they're not catching enough people coming across the border. When you hear that a relatively small percentage of this heroin in this country is coming across in places other than the points of entry, that's because we're not catching as many people.
So he's saying, in effect, he was arguing for a border wall there. He's saying drugs are being smuggled in these non-legal points of entry, and we just don't know it because we're not catching people doing that. What do you say to that argument?
Well, there is no evidence to support that claim at all. People get caught between legal ports of entry, and it's fairly rare that they will get caught with hard drugs. Before the significant legalization at state level of marijuana in the U.S., migrants were oftentimes forced by drug trafficking groups to carry cannabis. But that has dropped off because cannabis is now supplied and readily available by the United States itself. Drugs like heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, fentanyl is simply too valuable for drug trafficking groups to entrust to migrants. So it's just not being done. I also want to point out that beyond the drugs and vehicles, you have other methods. Tunnels, that was one of the methods that El Chapo, who is on trial in New York, pioneered. And fentanyl that the U.S. Gets predominantly from China, also goes through the post office, through regular post package courier services. And in fact, the vast majority of fentanyl still is smuggled, shipped directly to the U.S., not via Mexico and the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let's talk now a little bit about what this means for trying to catch these things. Let's start with what you were just talking about, fentanyl, these very potent synthetic opioids coming from China in particular. Are there enforcement methods that would allow us to catch and stop more of these drugs from coming into the country?
Well, it's possible to mandate greater screening of packages coming from China. That would often involve technology. It's difficult to use sniffer dogs because drugs like fentanyl, carfentanil, other synthetic analogs of opioids might be so potent that the exposure of dogs will actually kill them. And obviously, we don't want that. But you can imagine all kinds of chemical tracing. The problem with shipping from China is the problem with screening of shipping from China is the same that is the problem of screening cars and vehicles that come from Mexico. There are real economic costs to screening every single package. In fact, we can screen a tiny portion of the packages in the single digits. Otherwise, the legal trade would be halted, and that would have terrible consequences for the U.S. economy. Right after 9/11, the U.S. shut down its border with Mexico, fearing some terrorist attack across the southern border. That attack never took place. There's never been an attempt to have a terrorist attack across the southern border. But nonetheless, U.S. shut down the border. For 2 days, there was no traffic. And in the 2 days, the economic consequences for the U.S. economy were enormous. And there was tremendous pressure from U.S. businesses, from automakers and many others to reopen the border because of the economic costs. So the more you try to screen legal goods that are coming in for illegal contraband in them, the more you are running into the difficulty of how much that hampers and impedes the vital legal trade.
With Mexico in particular, I've seen the argument that one of the best tools is robust cooperation between U.S. law enforcement and Mexican law enforcement to try to stop the drugs flowing north, also to try to stop guns flowing south across that same border. How are we doing on that? Are we doing a good job cooperating between the two countries?
Well, for several years now, from the early 2000s until the Trump administration, the level of U.S.-Mexican cooperation really increased tremendously. The Merida Initiative that was signed by the George W. Bush administration and then the Calderon administration in Mexico really reinforced cooperation at a level that U.S. has not seen with Mexico ever, particularly until the middle 1990s. Relations with Mexico were often highly fraught. the level of cooperation persisted despite President Trump being elected and choosing very hostile rhetoric toward Mexico. But it nonetheless slowed and became much less enthusiastic on the Mexican part because President Trump has been constantly accusing Mexican people of being drug smugglers, rapists, of causing crime in the United States, of demanding the wall and demanding that Mexico pays for the wall. That has turned off both the Mexican government and the Mexican people of the idea of intense cooperation with the U.S. Now there is a new administration in Mexico. López Obrador has been the new president since December 1. Like President Trump, he is a populist politician, but on the left side of the spectrum. He wishes to have cooperative relations with the Trump administration, but at the same time, it's very clear that he has diametrically opposed views on how to deal with drug trafficking, how to deal with migrants, and the relationship will be challenged, and it's quite likely that many of the cooperative mechanisms established under Merida may be suspended or perhaps even discontinued.
Vonda, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Vonda Felbeb-Brown is an expert on the international drug trade and a senior fellow in the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution.
Reducing the number of people immigrating to the U.S. has been a top priority for the Trump administration.
One of the administration's earliest moves was to limit the number of refugees who came to the country. That's led to a sharp decline nationwide in the number of refugees who have resettled in the U.S. in recent years and the number resettling here in Wisconsin.
Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext. He recently took a closer look at these numbers in a new piece you can find online at wiscontext.org. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what do we know about how many refugees resettled in Wisconsin last year?
So last year, there were 472 refugees resettled in Wisconsin. That's about a little under 20% less than 2017. But really, the big difference is from 2016. It's over 75% decrease from the 2016 resettlements.
Do we have an idea or at least some idea as to why we're seeing less refugees now than in years past?
Sure. Yeah. So if you look at the charts that we have in WisContext, you can see kind of a general trend line going up during the first decade and a half of the 21st century. But yeah, you're right. Over the last couple of years, it's gone down quite a bit, and that is, we think, pretty much due to federal policy. For 2018, the Trump administration set the cap of refugees that would be accepted into the United States at 45,000, which was the lowest such cap basically since the refugee resettlement program began in 1980. And actually, the actual numbers of refugees resettled in the United States last year was much lower at almost 23,000. We also think there were fewer refugees because some previous refugees have been coming from countries that are affected by the travel ban, Somalia, Syria, a few other countries.
Now, you were referring to the charts that's in your piece about refugees and the drop-off. It also showed in your piece that there was a problem for some of the employers in the Milwaukee area. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah. So I haven't spoken to any of these employers myself, but I did hear from one source, Mary Flynn. She is the refugee resettlement coordinator in the Milwaukee area for Lutheran Social Services. And she told me that she has been hearing from a number of employers in the Milwaukee area who historically have depended on refugees for jobs that I guess otherwise a lot of local job seekers would not want. I guess they're for the most part lower paying jobs. Several employers told Ms. Flynn there in the Milwaukee area that they are kind of struggling looking for workers to replace this, what otherwise had been quite a large number of refugees coming to the Milwaukee area.
Now, it looks like there is a struggle there in the part of employers, at least in Milwaukee, in the state. But how do we compare to the rest of the country? Are you seeing that trend play out in other places around the country?
Sure, yeah. So refugee numbers are down across the nation, you're correct. And really, it does vary wildly from state to state how many refugees they received last year and historically over the last couple of decades. Wisconsin has consistently ranked about middle of the pack. In 2018, Wisconsin was placed 20th, I think, in number of refugees that were resettled. There's several states that resettle a lot of refugees. Those include Texas, Washington State, Ohio, California. Often states with already larger populations. And then there's also, on the flip side, some states that received no refugees last year. So that would be Hawaii, Wyoming. And yeah, there's a very wide range.
Is there a difference besides the population between states like Texas and California that are receiving a lot of refugees versus Wisconsin who have experienced a drop-off? Is it a matter of the type of employers that are in those states? What is driving that?
So what's driving the actual location of the refugee resettlements is it's pretty complex, but I think boiled down, some of the biggest factors are kind of historical ties to already established refugee communities. So a lot of refugees are reuniting with relatives, family members, friends who they know from their nation of origin. So they're going to those same communities. Also, a lot of the resettlement agencies that work on resettling refugees, they'll place refugees kind of in the same areas that they're familiar with working in already.
Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext, and we're talking about the decline in the number of refugees that are settling in the state of Wisconsin. When you look at the charts that you've included in your piece, there was a big spike in the number of refugees in 2004. What was behind that?
Right, yeah. So I mentioned earlier that there is a pretty gradual trend line moving up from about 2002 to 2016 in the number of refugees, but that doesn't include this, you're right, a big spike in 2004 and to a lesser extent in 2005. That is related to, those are primarily Hmong refugees who had left Laos and were in the last Thai refugee camp that closed right around that time. And so there is a large number of Hmong refugees who were in that last refugee camp in Thailand who came to Wisconsin because they have historical ties to several Wisconsin communities.
Now, you talked about folks from Laos that were coming in 2004 and 2005. What do we know about the refugees that are coming here now in 2019?
Sure. Yeah, so it's changed quite a bit. Basically, starting in about 2006 or 2007, there are a large and growing number of refugees coming from Burma, also known as Myanmar. And these are refugees who belong to a couple different groups. One is the Karen people. Another one, which our listeners maybe have heard quite a bit of about in the last year or so, are the Rohingya. They're a predominantly Muslim minority from Burma. That have been essentially the target of ethnic cleansing, genocide by the ruling military regime.
Now, how does the resettlement process work for refugees?
It's quite a long, complicated process. It can take anywhere from like a year and a half to over 2 years for once a refugee has begun the process to be resettled. It starts with usually a designation from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who then works with, in the case of the United States, with the U.S. State Department, who coordinates with several other federal agencies, all sorts of screenings from health screenings to security screenings. There's a lot that goes into it, and the vetting process is pretty extensive, but yeah, it can take quite a long time. And actually, I think only about 1% of the refugees who kind of apply with the UN actually make it through the process to resettlement in any given year.
And do we know where refugees are being resettled here in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So Metro Milwaukee is definitely the largest destination for refugees in the state. Makes sense. It's the largest population center in the state. But otherwise, the Fox Cities are also a popular destination. Appleton and Oshkosh, and I think that is partly driven by the resettlement agencies that work in the Fox Cities. They're already growing refugee populations there. Also Dane County and historically the Wausau area and some other larger counties as well. But they're resettled kind of in communities all throughout the state. Barron, Wisconsin is a pretty small town up in northwestern Wisconsin. They have a sizable Somali refugee population. It depends.
And finally, what did you hear from the people who work on resettling refugees about what they think about the drop in numbers?
Sure. I would say they still view obviously their work is very important needed. And I think while they, from what I heard in my interviews with them, they're disappointed with the decreasing numbers of refugees coming to Wisconsin and to the United States. They have, to varying extents, planned for it. Basically, since the Trump administration announced in the beginning of 2017 that they were going to be capping the refugees at a much lower number, they've been able to plan for it staffing-wise. I think they are looking to continue their services in whatever capacity they can. One refugee resettlement organization in Wisconsin, Catholic Charities of Milwaukee, did end their resettlement program in July, but the other half a dozen or so are still gone.
Will, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Darrell.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisConText, talking to us about why we're seeing a decline in the number of refugees in Wisconsin. You can find his piece at wisconText.org.
Congress and President Trump reached an agreement last Friday to fund the federal government through February 15th. But with the issue of border wall funding still up in the air, another partial shutdown could be around the corner.
During the last stalemate, groups like the National Endowment for the Arts, the Smithsonian Institution, and the National Science Foundation were deemed non-essential services and had to close their doors. In a recent opinion piece for the Washington Post, our next guest says America's founders saw knowledge-based services as vital to democracy and that the Trump administration has repeatedly tried to dismantle the country's intellectual life.
Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is the Merle Curdy Professor of History at UW-Madison and the author of the forthcoming book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, you've got an argument about what happened in the short run and then about the long run. Let's start with the short run. What do you see as the impact of this shutdown that just ended for now on intellectual life in America?
Well, let me take this in two parts, if I may. So let's take it up till last Friday, midday. Mm-hmm. So before the shutdown ended. And that was, where to begin? Basically, the funding got cut off to so many of our museums. So the Smithsonian Museums, it got cut off to the National Science Foundation and many other data collecting agencies, federally funded agencies. And so what happened? It meant that everything came to a shutdown. It meant that our collections in the Smithsonian's, which is the world's biggest complex of museums, was shut down. Shut down not only to the public, but also researchers. What that meant was that scientists who were federally funded were not able to access their data. We're not able to conduct their research. Researchers couldn't have access even through websites to some of these collections. So and then we can go on from there. Our arts programs pulled, traveling exhibits pulled. That was then, and now. I've been in touch with a number of people. So now that it's back up and running. It'll take a while to figure out what the long-term damage is going to be, right? So for the historian who couldn't access the archives, he can go back in. All right, he lost a week or two of his research. For the scientists who have lapses in data collection, that's not clear what's going to happen as a result of it. traveling exhibits that were put on ice, it's not clear what's going to happen to them, you know, and what the longer term financial consequences are going to be.
And you write that you are concerned about the Trump administration, not just during the shutdown, but in its approach to information, data, knowledge collection.
Well, unfortunately, it's not just the Trump administration. This has been part of the GOP's platform for quite some time now, for the last couple of decades. But the Trump administration is just carrying on a long, you know, longstanding, semi-longstanding pattern of wanting to make, you know, reduce federal funding for things like the NEH or the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, public broadcasting, your livelihood. In their last budget, I mean, they wanted radical cuts to it. And we'll see if that happens again this year. I expect that that'll happen again this year.
And then let's turn to the big picture. That's the wider point you make in your piece is that these sorts of things have been a priority since the founding of the country on. Can you talk about some of that history?
Yeah, that was something, you know, it's a piece that I wrote for The Washington Post. And of course, we're constrained by only so many thousand words. But the point that I wanted to get across in that is that this isn't a partisan issue. I mean, that this is, if you look back historically, as you said, since the founding, Whigs, Democrats, you know, progressives, Republicans. I mean, this was something that all Americans could rally around really up until the last 20 years or so has that been an issue. But yeah, in terms of our founders, you can't not find a founding father who did not think that the free circulation of knowledge was crucial and the production of knowledge, right? So not just circulating knowledge that we were able to carry over in ships from Europe, but rather knowledge that was produced right here, right in America, right on our own, you know, native grounds here, and that production and circulation of knowledge was crucial for distinguishing citizens from subjects, right? So if we're going to have people who are going to rule themselves and self-rule, they need a baseline set of knowledge, facts, understanding, and conversation. So the movement and sharing of that information in order that they can exercise what it means to be a democratic citizen. So they thought this was just a fundamental part of democratic practice.
Can you talk about some of the institutional ways that that took life in the early 1800s and on?
A couple of the things that I mentioned in the piece, one was the founding of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And this was founded by John Adams and James Hancock and a couple of others who wanted to have a place that would basically foster, you know, humanistic and scientific research as well as exchange. And it was also a way to announce to the world, we've arrived. Yes. Yeah? So no, we not only have our political freedom, but we also have our intellectual independence. So the optics of that was very important to the founders. Another example is when Adams became president. This is when we have the founding of the Library of Congress in 1800. So that originally started out, again, the notion that if we're going to have enlightened representation, then our representatives need access to, you know, the latest law, the latest literature on science, the latest political theory. And so in 1800, the Library of Congress was founded with that idea of enlightened governance. But it didn't take long for it to actually reach out and become something that was supposed to be available to all American citizens.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, a professor of history at UW-Madison, talking about U.S. government support, U.S. founder support for intellectual endeavors, scientific, civic, and more. You said it wasn't a partisan issue for many years, decades for that matter. Why do you think it became more of a partisan issue?
Well, I think that, I think that's a complicated answer, but I think we can clearly identify the period when things really turn around, and that's during the famed culture wars of the early 90s. And I think a number of things went into that, which made public funding of the arts and the humanities in particular, not the sciences, not the natural sciences, but the arts and humanities, a real kind of hot button issue in public discourse. As you might recall, there was the battle over the Mapplethorpe exhibit. So, you know, federal funding for what some argued, reasonably argued, was pornography. And why is the federal government funding, you know, an exhibit in what's essentially pornographic photographs. There was the big debate over the bombing of the Enola Gay and at the Smithsonian, and there was an effort to kind of show both the, you know, the good side of that story, but also the darker side of that story, you know, and try to give the full range of facts about what happened. But that caused a huge public uproar, in some cases by former you know, veterans of World War II who were offended, and others, you know, in their name, you know, sort of offended that there would be a negative version to the good war. You know, this was the good war. And then there became the history debates. And so this became a very kind of public debate about what is this federal funding going to, and whose version, you know, whose version of history, whose version of art? And there's a very clear logic for many Republicans who are small government Republicans who might, you know, legitimately make an argument, which is like, the arts are fine, you know, history is fine, all of that is fine, but that is something that should be public or privately funded and not publicly funded. But the, you know, the conversation was very, very, very contested and kind of metastasized from there. And I really think that's a turning point in both where we see sort of pressures on funding towards these sorts of resources, as well as the sort of charged conversation around them.
We are talking with UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her recent op-ed in the Washington Post looking at the government shutdown and its effects on America's intellectual infrastructure.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does it worry you that groups like the Smithsonian and the National Science Foundation are often considered non-essential during government shutdowns? Do you agree with our guest that spreading knowledge is vital to a healthy democracy? If you're a researcher, scholar, how have shutdowns affected you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're continuing our talk with Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, UW-Madison history professor, about the latest shutdown's impact on America's intellectual life.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. In the short run, do you worry about what happens when archives, research foundations, museums, and more get closed down? Do you think society needs more of a reverence for and support for knowledge and the organizations that make it possible? Do you have a question for our guest based on what she said so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Jennifer, we've seen the phrase marketplace of ideas out in the public eye a lot, and the idea that why should the government put its finger on the scale? A concern that in funding various kinds of research, universities, and more, maybe that's skewing us in one way or another.
Sure, that's a concern of some, and I think it's a legitimate concern of some. I guess I would say two things. One is, I've never been much a fan for the phrase marketplace of ideas, because marketplaces are often not places of free exchange, right? I mean, there's constraints. There's have nots. There are people who have access to resources, those who don't. So I think the marketplace metaphor, I think, is problematic. The second thing that I would say is that if someone's going to make a call, you know, some administrator somewhere or a group somewhere is going to make a call about what's going to get funded, what isn't. Of course, all of these decisions are highly vetted from lots and lots of experts and often a lot of public input. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you think that knowledge, both the production of it as well as the free, you know, circulation of it, is crucial for the well-being of our democracy, then there has to be a space in the public, right, as part of the public domain, the public good, that is fostering this, supporting this, and serving as a structure for it.
And I think you mentioned a distinction in some cases between, okay, maybe we can support science and technology research. We see an economic benefit. The idea that you're talking about going back to the founders, that this sort of general intellectual endeavors are good for us as citizens, that might feel, I don't know, distant from people today. Do you want to make the case that it shouldn't feel so distant?
I would hope that, our listeners here, that every one of them at one point has stepped into one of our fabulous federally funded, you know, museums or archives. The National Archives houses our very own Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. These are the founding documents. And that's a public good that belongs to the public. It doesn't belong in a private museum. It doesn't belong in a private sphere. I just think that, I say this both also as someone who researches this, to see how my sense of this isn't just, I mean, yes, it's my opinion, and my concerns as a private citizen, but it's also my what I'm learning as a researcher, that this is a priority that has been axiomatic for so many Americans up until our day.
Do you think, actually, I want to go to a caller now before we run out of time. Valerie is with us in Cross Plains. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Valerie?
So I work here in Madison at the National Wildlife Health Center. It's part of the Department of the Interior. And I think when people think about Department of the Interior, they might just think about national parks closing. But what we do at the Wildlife Center is we investigate diseases in wildlife, including when there are unusual mortality events that we have to respond to right away to find out what's going on. And we look for pathogens that might affect, besides affecting the wildlife, which is important in itself, but also domestic animals or human health. And we're not able to do that when the government is shut down.
So your work was closed down while you were doing that? Or while the shutdown was going on?
Yeah, we could not do that during the shutdown. So if there had been an event that required immediate diagnosing of what's going on, we couldn't do it.
Valerie, thank you for calling in and sharing that story. That's one of many worries you had about the shutdown, Jennifer.
Those were precisely what Valerie just shared with us, was the sort of thing that I was hearing over and over again. And that's sort of what, by humanistic researchers as well as scientists like Valerie. And I thought about that. And in fact, even to do some of my own research, I tried to access the Smithsonian, and then the Skull and Crossbones pops up and it says, shut down, sorry, we're closed. And I thought, what does it mean for us to communicate to each other, as citizens, as well as to the world, that these sorts of, this sort of work, like the work that Valerie is doing, is not essential, is not essential for the functioning of our and vibrancy of our democracy.
In our last few moments, thanks for that call, Jennifer, do you think that maybe the shutdown will highlight this kind of work and maybe swing the pendulum in another direction?
Oh, I would love to think so. I would hope so. One does not need to be a professional historian to know that we're living in a very charged political environment and highly partisan environment. So it'll be interesting to see where this debate goes through February 15th.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about her recent piece for The Washington Post, looking at the impact of the latest government shutdown on knowledge-based organizations. We'll be talking to her probably the next month or two about her new book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History.
Wisconsin has a shortage of quality, affordable housing, but people with disabilities often have fewer options. Phoebe Petrovic reports on one group of parents taking unusual steps to help their children with disabilities find housing tailored to their needs.
On a Tuesday in Mount Horeb, five women have gathered at a cafe table crowded with coffee cups and thick binders.
Why don't you talk about your homework? So my homework is...
Today, they're talking about grant applications. Some are specific.
Oh, here's the one. Do not use grant funds on posters and excessive begging.
The group needs to raise $500,000 to help build an apartment complex they're calling Home of Our Own. These parents and grandparents all have adult children with disabilities who still live with them. The group's leaders, Marianne Omakin and Susan Wallach, met over 20 years ago when their children, Amy and Frank, were in preschool. Amy and Frank both have autism and are nonverbal. Wallach says she and Omakin often spoke about their children's futures.
What happens when our children grow up, and where are they going to live, and what are their lives going to look like? Because we know these are not going to be children who are going to be independent someday.
Amy and Frank are now in their mid-20s and still live with their parents. But Omakin knows their children can't live with them forever.
Let's face it, we are going to die one day. And we would much rather plan thoughtfully and to not have the planning be driven by a crisis.
The parents worry about what will happen when they're no longer able to care for their children. And they say they don't want to put them in group homes or isolated apartments, worrying it might expose them to abuse. People with intellectual disabilities experience sexual assault at a rate 7 times that of those without disabilities, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. So Omakin says that for the past 6 years, the families behind Home of Our Own have met weekly, trying to figure out how to build a place where their children can live on their own, safely and affordably, among friends and neighbors in rural Wisconsin.
This is a really, really determined set of parents, and we just refused to give up.
They dreamed up a specific plan, an integrated community in small-town New Glarus, welcoming residents of all abilities and incomes. Disability advocates, nonprofit developers, and state officials all say there is a shortage of affordable, accessible housing in Wisconsin. Even without a detailed wish list, it's slim picking, says Jason Belongi, Assistant Director of Access to Independence, which serves people of all disabilities and ages in South Central Wisconsin.
There's a very significant shortage of housing stock that is both affordable and accessible for people with disabilities.
In the past few years, the state has seen an increased demand for supportive housing, like Home of Our Own, where some residents get assistance from caretakers. That's according to the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. David Ginger oversees their allocation of tax credits for affordable developments.
I suspect I could allocate all my tax credits to supportive housing for the next couple of years and still not make a huge dent into the need.
Home of Our Own has applied for these tax credits, which would largely cover the $8 million project. They've also gotten approval from New Glarus. They have secured a plot of land and drawn up building designs. Omakin says they're getting closer.
Oh my gosh. In some ways, it feels like this has been the longest journey of our lives. But in other ways, it feels like all of a sudden it's moving really quickly.
It's been tough, but Susan Wallach, the group's other leader, says their children have kept them going.
Our children are the most amazing teachers, and they're the most remarkable people. And if we are strong, it is because our children have taught us to be strong.
If the parents succeed, they'll create 40 new homes in Wisconsin. But advocates say there are still thousands of people needing quality, affordable, accessible housing. And to answer that need, it'll take more than just a few dedicated parents. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest says it's time to reform the Electoral College in a way that both parties could support.
Have you heard of this thing called the Internet of Things? It has everything from refrigerators to cars to, yes, blenders getting online connections. A cybersecurity expert tells us why these connected products are creating big new risks for hacking.
And an expert on college finance tells us why middle-class families are being priced out of higher education at many schools.
All that, plus we'll take a look at some of the latest news stories of today. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.